You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is March 31st, 2021. Before we begin the topic for this week, I want to note, I don't know how many people are aware of this, but the great Rick Adams died a few days ago. Rick Adams and I go back quite a long time. He was one of the main broadcasters at Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, and he was one of the very first people to ever interview me or really take a professional interest in me in terms of broadcasting. I believe it was 2001. I was the editor of the Barnes Review, and we were putting on what turned out to be a very large conference in Washington, D.C. And Willis Cardo had brought in Rick as our master of ceremonies. I hadn't heard of the guy before. Also, Paul Tapiti from Poker Face was the entertainment. And that was the first time I met either one of those guys, and of course I was very, very good friends with them ever since. But because we had to work together over those few days, Rick and I became friends. And we had a lot in common. Of course, he's a nationalist in every respect. And actually, the very first person that ever interviewed me was Tom Valentine, who was connected with Liberty Lobby many years ago. But then Rick, and this was roughly around the first time, or my first book came out. So this is maybe, 2001, something like that. Either was out or about to come out. And that was the topic of discussion. I came off very well in the air. This is Rick's show was a traditional talk radio show. You had advertising and you had callers and everything else. And I learned how useless most callers to radio shows are. And both the Tom Valentine show and the Rick Adams show, I talked about the same thing. My first book, The Third Rome, and the myths and stories about old Russia. After my appearance on Rick's show for the first time, I began to be noticed, and this is how I got in contact with the people from The Voice of Reason. And it was Peter Schenck, I believe it was, who interviewed me a short time thereafter. And then they said, this guy is knowledgeable. He needs to have a regular show on him. And that's how things, of course, that was several years later. I had been on Rick's show many times. Of course, after the Barnes Review, I was teaching at a university. And so I had young children at the time. So it took a little time, but Rick Adams was the man who kind of introduced me to the broadcasting world. He was extremely humble. He didn't seem to have an ego at all. He was extremely knowledgeable, and he didn't wear it on his sleeve. It took a lot to get him angry or upset. He was extremely easy to deal with, which is pretty rare. Most of us bleed at the touch. So his death is a gigantic loss. The last time I was on his show was 2019. And he made a comment. We were talking about foreign policy. And of course, you know, a common theme with me is that the U.S. is trying to pick a war with Russia or China or both. And I was, you know, we were discussing this, and I said, this is suicidal. The United States can't defeat the Somalians. They can't defeat the Taliban, let alone the Russians or the Chinese, both of them together. There is absolutely no chance of victory here. And Rick replied, he said, what makes you think that victory is the final purpose? It's chaos and bringing down a system that they don't like. That's the purpose here. The mass carnage is its own end. And I quote that all the time. It's one of the many lines from Rick that stuck with me. That was the last time we spoke. And so this is a gigantic loss. And you know, my great fear when we lose someone like that, like when Michael Collins Piper died, even when Willis Carter died, John Tiffany died, I just, you know, do we have the people to replace them? And that's the key. Because we're living in a time where no one really wants that job. This is not the easiest life that someone can choose. You know, all your predictions can come true and no one's going to notice because you're some kind of an extremist. What's happening now is that I'm putting my stuff is always being taken by others, plagiarized all over the place, usually a month or so after I put something out. And what seems to be happening here is I'll put out an idea. Like when I was defending the record of the Assad government in Syria. No one had done that. I was doing it in 1991. Well, people are reading this and they're seeing how it plays out. I've done all the work, of course. And they're seeing over a few months how it plays out. Is it accepted? Is there really a lot of evidence here? Then what someone will do is, sometime later, put out a one or two syllable version of that. And because they have far more media clout than me, are able to pass it off as their own. This happens all the time. It's a technique. It's like university professors. You know, they assign papers in class. Well, for college students, especially grad students, one of the purposes of that is to get free research. The students will do all this work, go through all these books and articles. Of course, it's not copyrighted, and the professor can take it and do what he wants with it. He now has 20, 30, in some cases, skilled researchers at his disposal. And I've seen this blatantly happen, where professors assign papers and exactly what they're working on at the moment. It's the same thing. These guys, and most of you know who I'm talking about, there's a group of them, more mainstream, but they're called conservative types, who will allow me to do all the work. But not only that, they're able to see how these ideas then get digested elsewhere. They can be, you know, immediately rejected, or they can be accepted slowly. And then after a while, when that's died down, they can then put a different version of the exact same thing out, making similar arguments and claim that it's theirs. So the point I'm trying to make is that, and Rick and I have spoke about this many times, it's a thankless, difficult job. But I recognize something else, and that my listeners, my readers, are one of the main reasons that I continue to do this. It's not thankless, at least in that sense. To a great extent, I rely on donations, as you all know, especially over the last few years. And my listeners and readers have stepped up. And you guys have been very generous. And I truly and really appreciate it. And speaking of which, I also want to note, I get a lot of emails. I have several email addresses. Occasionally I forget about them. I log on and there are about 2,000 messages of varying quality. And I have numerous ways to get in touch with me. And I can't possibly answer everyone. And I feel terrible. There was a time I was able to do that. In fact, Willis Cardo, when I was at the Barnes Review, he used to really insist you respond to every single letter. That was actually an incident he had with Gerald L.K. Smith. Long story, but he really had an issue with ignoring people. In this case, I'm not ignoring you. I am on my own here. And it's a struggle. But so if I don't respond, it's not a personal matter. And some messages I get are very lengthy and complicated. I'm not doing research for people. I'm not ignoring you. I'm not, that is not my purpose. Sometimes I get back to people, months later, and they have no idea what I'm talking about. So that being said, rest in peace to the great Rick Adams, someone who we can't afford to lose. I mentioned last week that my 13th book is out, published by Ramada Books, In Regione Che Corum Rex et Luscus, Essays on Medieval Political Philosophy. These have been, as you know, the Middle Ages have been a concern of mine for so many years. And, since my undergraduate years, that the rhetoric against the Middle Ages is so overwhelmingly dark and nonsensical that even as an 18-year-old, I realized this couldn't possibly be true. And in fact, it was my reaction to this anti-medieval stuff. I began to notice, this was a the Christian era. This was a royalist era. This was an anti-usury era. This was an anti-capitalist era. Everything that the current regime lives for. I'm as much a medievalist as I am a nationalist. And that is manifest in the topic I want to talk about today. It's actually a paper I wrote in 2016. The title is The Romantic Neo-Medieval Synthesis, Nominalism, John Ruskin, and the Destruction of Thought. This is one of those that, has been around a long time, and I've not done a broadcast on it. I've not dealt with it. But now, while this paper is not in my medieval book, I think it works as a introduction to it. It also bridges a gap between the medieval mind and the romantic nationalist mind later on. Because the nationalist movement, whether it be, Scott or Herder or Ruskin himself, saw the ethnic idea as essentially a medieval one. Johann Herder, in his rejection of the Enlightenment, saw the medieval concept found in the folk nationality. Don't get too lost in the medieval idea that this was just a purely Latin-speaking, feudal Catholic movement. That was not the case in most of Europe. That really concerns the Frankish Empire, to a much less extent the German, the Holy Roman Empire later, post-Charlemagne, and it barely, in parts of Spain. It doesn't even really refer to much of Italy. The ethnic idea was very important in the Middle Ages. And it's developed to a high degree, especially in the Russian realm, the Greek realm, the Byzantine Empire after a certain period of time. And Poland, the Western Slavic areas, the Serbians and the Magyars all had their ethnic awakenings in this era. Latin was the language of the elite in certain parts of medieval Europe, but that is not a universal phenomenon. Now, and I mention this primarily because the romantic concept, and especially speaking of the Voice of Reason, when I did the Voice of Reason broadcast, I did a lot on the romantic movement and what romantic political ideology means. Romantic and ethno-nationalist were, for me, essentially one and the same. This was the folk nation, not the elites in the cities. The romantic idea, there's even a national romantic school in Scandinavia, which I did a lecture on many years ago. But the romantic idea is the cultural, ethnic, and folk anarchist. An anarchist in the sense of this is not a statist ideology. This is a cultural ideology. It's an alternative to modern rationalism. The language of Herder or Scott or John Ruskin himself remains the verbiage of the counter-revolutionary. John Ruskin, who died in 1900, was one of the dominant art critics, late 19th century. He defended the medieval idea initially in the art world, which makes a lot of sense, but then that became a matter for the social and political world too. Now, these fields aren't really separate from each other. But the target of the romantic, nationalist, and medieval idea is the urban, bureaucratic, the stratified, class-based life, which in modernity masquerades as freedom or even reason or even reality. Today we live in a hyper-bureaucratized, a completely standardized mass production culture. The opposite of that would be the mystic and ethnic populism of the medieval, Gothic, and Romantic idea. It's considered either, you know, hopelessly utopian or the means of escape. Not to mention the fact, I wrote this many years ago, it's a challenge to the Americanist paleoconservative idea. Revolutionary nationalism looks to foreign models, since the world of the American founding was already modern. The American Constitution, in many ways, is relevant because it could not take into consideration media empires, Judaic banking control, the conglomerate, completely subverts whatever wisdom was to be found in the Constitution. The U.S. was built as a hybrid state. You had elements of the Roman Republic with elements of the Enlightenment. Now, of course, in the founding generation, it was a completely different world in terms of virtue and understanding. And, of course, it's utopian compared to today. The truth is that it's a compromise. The Constitution was a compromise cobbled together haphazardly with tremendous opposition, done in secret, and early on with little hope of success. The Civil War proved that the opponents of the Constitution were correct. The American Constitution no longer functions. It has no role in American life today. That's been going on for a long time. But after the Civil War, the total mobilization of World War I and World War II, it's been held together by guns, as I've said many times, held together by guns and drugs. Now, art, religion, politics. As I said before, these aren't really separate fields. They derive from something more fundamental. And this is why Romanticism is so important, because this is a stress on the whole, the all. The all that is beyond categories of thought. You can't really conceptualize the whole. It's too large. Modernity forces our external world to conform itself to our logical designs, because the elite, the self, is seen outside of the natural order. It's always been this strange contradiction, and you really have to look to alchemy to understand how you can have a materialist science in the Enlightenment in France and in Britain in many ways, but still have this stress on the seeking individual, so-called scientist, whatever. The pentagram, one of the symbols of it, the pentacle, is the idea of number four, which of course is the number of death, north, south, east, west. But then the upper point in the star is the mind. That's the initiated mind. That's the mind of the elite. But somehow it's outside of the natural order and dominates it. That's what vitiates it. It distorts the external world. And its purpose is to extract more and more resources out of it. That's the nature of modern industrialization and everything that comes from it. The Romantic movement, 19th century, was based on a return to the Middle Ages, a world untainted by mass warfare or industry. So rather than what I used to call the imperial categories of logic, which is no surprise connected with the British Empire and the Dutch Empire and the Portuguese Empire, the Romantics sought to grasp the natural whole as a matter of intuition, which technically means prior to the imposition of our concepts upon it. If you consider the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were innocent. They were, of course, far from perfect. They were innocent prior to the fall. They didn't have a discursive language like we have today, because everything was intuition. They really didn't have to think. They didn't need steps. They just understood. The communication was all-encompassing. Once they were tempted with promises of power and building a city, which of course is what the first thing Cain did, they became alienated from the world. Animals were then frightened of them. Nature became an opponent rather than a partner. So the Romantic idea in terms of science is to consider the world prior to our imposition of what really is an artificial schema of logical categories on it. I note, and I've noted this many times, that it used to be that herbal healing, peasant wisdom, ancient recipes were mocked. This was exactly the backward world that the Enlightenment tried to eliminate. We have to progress from that. Utopia can't be found until we get rid of all that nonsense. And yet now it's been completely rediscovered. The ancient, largely non-European for obvious reasons, but the ancient rural life, then and now, seen as more authentic and popular and even democratic than its opposite, the factory floor, the cubicle, or the crime-ridden urban mass. All of a sudden, people noticed that what we're told now to worry about, whether it be pollution or plastics or even GMOs now, EMF, all this stuff. Initially, these were supposed to be the vehicles of our liberation. Everything now that allegedly is destroying the planet just a few generations ago, depending on what it is, were touted as the bringer of utopia. This was the scientific statement. Modern science will bring us peace and plenty through all of these new technologies and production techniques that now are recognized as poisonous. So over the last generation or so, you see this rise of, again, you know, they stress the Asian Chinese cultures as if medieval Europeans didn't have their own herbal and folk wisdom. Somehow they have to go elsewhere. But the truth is that folk tales and the ancient songs and old traditions were certainly far closer to the ordinary person than the elite and then what today even the urban scientific establishment. These medieval ideas were both democratic in the true real sense of the term and representative in the sense that they are based on the folk. So Romanticism, which derives from this, the mixture of ethnic, religious, and medievalist ideas. So now, what was just a few generations ago considered the ultimate backward primitive life, peasant medicine, the peasant life, the peasant ritual, now has a very impressive scientific backing for how rational it always was. The linear view of history is collapsing. To believe that history is this progress from primitive to advanced is to be completely historically illiterate. It assumes what it's trying to argue. The basic foundation of the Romantic movement, you know, whether it be economics, philosophy, you know, Adam Mueller, Johann Herder, it's the rejection of abstraction. There is no such thing as a citizen or an individual or even a person. There are Germans, there are Swedes, there are farmers, but there is no abstract individual. The ethnic collective is a very concrete entity that you can actually see and experience. That means that societies and peoples are self-contained. They follow their own internal path. Which means that no single scientific conception can be imposed universally. Of course, modern imperialism, as well as actually 19th century imperialism, was based on the idea of progress. Imperialism was based on the idea that these are savages, and we will bring to them the ideas of Darwin and industry and liberal democracy. And to the extent that they adopt those things, they are advanced. To the extent that they reject those things, they are primitive. And if they reject those things for a long time, we need to use force. And of course, it just so happens it was also very profitable. But significantly, the ethnic idea was essential to the Romantic imagination. It was popular, it was spontaneous, and it was holistic. Spontaneous in the sense that there was no plan for this. This is how people, as Gumilev says, this is how they've interacted with their environment. The ethnos and its language. When I say language, I mean all forms of communication, not just words. These were never imposed from above, like the modern state was. The folk humanized the natural world so as to make nature a home, a homeland. To humanize nature is to make it a national entity. The organic connection between societies and nature and the person within it and the social order is made explicit through language. But again, language is all forms of social interaction and social communion. The national romantic idea, one of the central elements of my career and of course this show, modernity created moral disorder. In fact, it was based on moral disorder. And that leads to state centralization, and eventually urban industry, and now things like GMOs, the very opposite of any conception of liberty or freedom. Now, the classical idea of both the ancient and the post-Renaissance world focused on straight lines. The classical idea, again, in its classical in the sense of opposing romantic, is focused on straight lines and sharp contours. The facades were very harsh and foreboding. Think of the state house in a colonial outpost. Power and empire were really the only messages of this. The spiritual life, the inner peace, the intuitive connection amongst organic entities, opposed to this idea, were far more significant than any labor-saving device. But the modern Renaissance classicism? Is it obsession with regularity and material wealth that doomed modernity to really become post-modernity, the expression of mass culture created by elites who remain anonymous? In my book, one of the longest sections in the book deals with architecture and art, because these cannot, under any circumstances, be separated from political ideology. The Romantic architects, and again, Ruskin was one of these people, reassessed the Middle Ages and acknowledged that the Gothic, the cultural world, and in this case of the High Middle Ages, the Gothic is High Middle Ages, the Romanesque is previous to this, was based on an extraordinary symbolic genius. The academic classicism, I'm not referring to, you know, I'm referring to almost a caricature of Greece and Rome. Its offshoots were the expression of a new world control in urban finance. The Romantic was a counter-revolution of tradition, ethnicity, and the peasant commune, what Mueller calls the moral economy. So the idea is that the Romantics, the ethno-nationalists coming from it, make war on any ideology that holds that the individual can exist apart from the whole. And that whole has to be an organic whole, almost by definition. The difference between a community and a collective. A collective is artificial, community is organic. But 19th century, the architecture was this ongoing battle between the cosmopolitan classicism and the folk romance. The classic school focused on simplicity, power, the use of newer, artificial, stronger materials in construction. It was based on logical abstraction. It only had function. The form was of little interest. You think of the old Soviet architecture of the 50s and 60s. These boxes. So instead of the logical abstraction of the academic classicist idea, the Romantic building is far more sophisticated. It's a complex entity that's connected with the locality. An example of the classicist idea is Petersburg. When Peter the Great imposed this classicist idea, which essentially was a neo-pagan idea, as a Gnostic sacrifice in the swamps of the Russian north. The architecture has no bearing on Russian tradition, especially the tradition of the area. It's bizarre to see Orthodox cathedrals having these huge facades, like a state house somewhere, or a courthouse, that may have a little onion dome on top. Everything was revolutionized. Again, one of the reasons why the old believers, one of the essential, what we might call a romantic reaction, did so well at the time. Tradition, culture, and nature are synthesized together. This is the essence of the romantic and medieval. The academic classicist idea, we have symmetry and regularity. These are tedious, because very little in life or nature is symmetrical, and certainly nothing is abstract, and very little is simple. John Ruskin is someone who I kind of, back in 15, 16, I was very into him. The romantic and medievalist reaction to the modern world, he's one of the first-rate expositors of this, not just in architecture, but in social theory as well. He was concerned with the romantic idea as a sort of a neo-medieval uprising. He saw it as the apogee of the High Middle Ages, roughly, you know, the beginning of the 13th century to the start of the Renaissance. The Gothic was very complex, incredibly intricate, and colossal in size. The modern doesn't understand what all these symbols are. Why spend so much time worrying about numbers and these angles and these icons, and the Gothic mentality is so complicated. But it seems chaotic only if you are ignorant of it. But if you look at the ancient, if you look at the medieval Gothic, what remains of it today before the regime burns them down, these are breathtaking. And they were built without any input from modern technology. Because the implication in Ruskin's ideas is that there is a way of life, a way of work, a way of production that the modern has forgotten. The structures on Mount Athos, built on the side of mountains. Very few architects and engineers would even begin a project like that, especially in that environment, and yet it's been there for a very long time. So Ruskin's idea, the Gothic, stressed the workman, stressed labor. It stressed the guild and the method of work as much as the product itself. But the guild stressed hierarchy, skill, and objective values, both in work and life. Technology took that place. Hierarchy and objective judgment makes sense only when it's ensconced in a particular field. You can't really talk about a better person, but you can talk about a better speaker or a better writer or a better, historian. If it's in a field, then you have objective criteria. So the Gothic cathedral and even the Romanesque before it, these are expressions of both worship, spiritual life, and the idea of cooperation, not competition. So this is what Ruskin says in his lectures on art, which he delivered before the University of Oxford in 1870. He says, "For in one point of view, Gothic is not only the best, but the only rational form of architecture, as being that which can fit itself most easily to all services, vulgar or noble, undefined in its slope or roof, height of shaft, breadth of arch, or disposition of ground plan. It can shrink into a turret, expand into a hall, coil into a staircase, spring into a spire, with undegraded grace and unexhausted energy. So, for as soon as the workman is left free to represent what subjects he chooses, he must look to the nature that is round about him for material, and will endeavor to represent it as he sees it, with small respect for law." The medieval mind was organic, natural, spiritual, but that didn't mean it wasn't logical. Logic, though, is subordinated to local custom, need, local materials. Everything that allowed logic to flourish in the first place. When Ruskin says that the workman is seeking to design what he chooses, this is a direct expression of autonomy, which Ruskin saw all around him destroyed in the filthy urban factories based on standard and mindless repetition and absolute death and destruction. I mean, I don't think we even could understand what it would be like in 1870 to go into a place like Birmingham and experience those factories. I don't think we even have a vocabulary to describe it. The filth, the destruction, all in the name of Darwinian progress. Now, the old classical idea, Ruskin criticizes it based on its artificiality. It's the architecture of domination, of administration. It's power, not authority. The Gothic style creates these huge spaces that imitate the sky, not the closed box like a prison cell. It's the artistic model of the cosmos. You see this in both East and West. The Gothic idea, light was meant to flood this otherwise material world, and the windows were made as large as possible, which was a technological development in between the Romanesque and the Gothic. Something was supposed to shine outward and reflect inward. Of course, the modern and postmodern workplace is a rectangular box existing only because of cost-benefit analysis. That's its sole reason for existing. Efficiency, profit, that creates your sharp edges and facades in all senses of that term. So the rejection of the modern idea by Ruskin and so many others, and it doesn't matter if it's in politics, economics, or art, is a rejection of this importation of an ideological, this abstract and mechanical conception on a society that already exists. The very concept of a revolution, you know, my doctoral dissertation and Michael Oakeshott was done very much on this topic. Societies, in any given moment, have their own way of doing things. A revolution has an already laid out, rational, logical plan that has absolutely nothing to do with the society that's going to get imposed on. Well, how do you bridge the gap between the ideological slogans and categories of the revolutionary plan on the one hand, and the society that already exists and functions for a long time on the other? And the answer is violence. My dissertation was based on that particular idea of Michael Oakeshott, referring to not just the Soviet system, but the French Revolutionary, the English Revolutionary, all of this in industry as a whole. And all of these movements were based on industry and production in one form or another. The form of something has to be tightly bound to its content and context. So that means importing material from external sources is rational. You build something that reflects the local mentality and local needs. The term organic is essential because it's the very process of maintaining a close tie to both nature and custom. So the opposite of organic is mechanical, artificial, and unnatural. One of the lesser known, but although he's a big name in philosophy, one of the biggest of all time, one of my favorites, dedicated my young intellectual life to, of course, was G.W.F. Hegel, who had his own brand of romanticism as a nationalist of a sort, and he dealt with this and the consequences in social life. And in writing about the Romantic movement, he says this, and he's talking about Romantic artist's foundation and purpose. In the representations of Romantic art, however, everything has its place. All spheres of life and phenomena, the greatest and the least, the highest and most restricted, the moral, the immoral, and base. And the more art becomes secularized, so much the more it does take up its abode in the finite things of this world. Conceive a preference, therefore, procure from them complete validity, and the artist is fortunate in them when he represents them as they are. Now, that's typical Hegel. You know, you have to read that 20 times before you, get a glimmer of what he's talking about. But he is darkly suggesting that the Romantic idea goes beyond and negates the modern fetish with categories and strict boundaries. There was no church or state in the Middle Ages. Those terms are modern terms. Government is an aspect of Christian life, while bishops, parishes, and monks, these are the moral guardians of education and truth. There was no clear boundary. Nothing is ever so neatly organized, not mentally or not externally. These boundaries exist only in the modern mentality. It's the same mentality that creates, whether it be the British Empire or the facade of the state house. On the one hand, you know, the church is a very abstract term for bishops and parishes and monks and moral idea. And the state, of course, is equally complex. Using those two terms are abstractions. We use them only as abbreviations and nothing more. But Romantic literature is the same way. The Romantic idea, early 19th century, created new heroes, like the Lonely Rebel. The Lonely Rebel... fighting for a lost cause, completely hostile to his environment. The counter-revolutionary. He is driven by this internal drive. The hero refuses all conventional judgments. He refuses all slogans that come from habit. Looking at the, you know, symbolically, you know, the Medici Rome or Medici Florence, looking at that money and power, he's like Savonarola. They're forced to seek a true way of life, away from the middle-class cities, dominion of usury. So in this era, you have a resurrection of the Byzantine past, the Frankish, but even the Asian past, rediscovered, and it was used to confront the failures of the Enlightenment. And these failures are already well known in the Medici Empire during the Renaissance, because so much of what came afterwards is based on the alchemy that the Medici banking clan created. They are the symbolic origin of the modern world. In opposition to that, modernity is replaced by so-called realism. Not realism in metaphysical sense, but in psychology, the social sciences. Realism pretends to be something that can explain our actions with the simplest of mechanical movements. Cost and benefit. Rational choice. Things that sound good on paper, but no one actually believes and no one actually does. But even people like Leo Tolstoy, for all his terrible errors, and even Rousseau, before him, rejected the naive mechanism of the Enlightenment idea and associated realism with what is actually real. The folk, the tradition, the things, the structures of survival that permitted civilizations to survive through war, famine, not to mention modern life and the money economy. The Enlightenment realism in a certain form of classicism didn't grasp man's inner world, because that's not an object like other objects. The only thing it could do is concern itself with external relations and economics and politics. So, of course, from this you get the absolute state, social science, Darwinism, industry. And these are very, very closely connected. The Renaissance was the cancellation of the Gothic. The Renaissance, through alchemy, extolled the mathematical, its new conception of the scientifically abstract, the desire to alter nature, to improve on it. The modern is based on the Renaissance conception of itself as resurrecting the ancient rituals, ancient paganism, alchemy, and magic. That was the so-called classic world that the Renaissance sought to resurrect. But this alchemy is significant. Its purpose is to harness the elemental forces for the sake of the practitioner, or the elite, the bankers in this particular case. Technology does the exact same thing, just without the incense. The Renaissance idea was urban, always was urban. It had no presence in the countryside at all. The Romantic idea, much later, was rural. I could even say the same with the Baroque. The Romantic, and yes, even the Baroque, looked to ancient empires rather than the people around them. The moderns termed the Gothic barbaric and fanatical. While, you know, the Roman Republic, obviously manifest in Renaissance Florence, was the apogee of truth and the beginning of progress. The Italian Renaissance was based to a great extent around, and actually had its foundation, the banking oligarchies and the rule of the moneyed few. So the Renaissance buildings in Florence and elsewhere in North Italy, fed by the Po Valley, were decked out in ornamentation. And the only people that could afford them was those at the very top of the social ladder. This was not a popular peasant connection with nature. They became obsessed with straight lines, pediments, geometric shapes of all kinds, and it's almost a reflection of their own alienation from the natural order. And its only purpose, really, was to be acceptable for their will. That's all nature was. It was a canvas for them to dominate. For decades, I've extolled the virtues, politically speaking, of Johann Herder, one of the founders, if not the founder, of the Romantic idea. His epistemology is absolutely essential because it's the core of the anti-Enlightenment critique of the, you know, what we call the purely mathematical, the logical conception of the universe. He's the founder of this movement, and his thought ties all everything we're talking about together into a holistic theory of man, nature, and God. Johann Herder himself can summarize what we've been talking about up until now, much of my whole career. Johann Herder, we're talking about the very end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century. Herder talks about the nature of human thought. He says, if that is to say, reason is not compartmentalized, separately effective force, but an orientation of all forces distinctive to a species, that the human being must have in it the first condition in which he is a human being. Posit the human being as the being that he is, with that degree of sensuality and that organization in the universe, from all sides, through all senses, this universe streams upon him in sensations. Where are the separate forces of reason? It is the positive, single force of the soul, which is effective in such a disposition. It's the same idea. Moderns separate reason from feeling. They separate reason and logic from history, from family. It's unrealistic. It's impossible. Humanity, or even our mind, can't be split up into functions or faculties. They function as a single entity. And the same goes for society. Same goes for the spiritual realm. Reason and logic in abstract sense are only aspects of human society. Things like love and social bonds, our instincts, can't be ignored. Fields like sociology start with the idea that there's no such thing as an instinct. An instinct can't necessarily be controlled, and therefore would be outside of their realm, so they can't admit its existence. And Herder says, in this respect, all volition indeed begins from cognition, but also, in its turn, all cognition only arises through sensation. I can only attain my own perfection through the perfection of others, as the latter can only do so through the former. We stand on higher ground, and with each thing in its ground move in a great sensorium of God's creation, the flame of all thought and sensation, love. Love is the highest reason, as it is the purest, most divine volition. Love is not some syrupy sentiment. It is the existence of the whole and our place in it. It's the interaction of all cosmic parts to the extent that to damage one small part will lead to the gradual destruction of the entirety. Love refers to those very powerful ties without which no life is possible. Now, I'm using the phrase romantic love, but that's nothing to do with our conceptions of romance. It only makes sense, though, when one begins to look at the very organization of the natural order. Parts of the whole only become truly individual to the extent that they serve the whole. They're useless. If you take a human lung and just hold it in your hand, it's not a lung. It's nothing. It's a hunk of nothing. It's only a lung when it's a part of a human body, when it's connected to blood vessels, when it's part of this huge, complicated organism. By itself, it's not a lung at all. It may look like one, but it's not one. It's only an individual thing when it actually functions within the whole. And by the 1840s, the Romantic movement was victorious. It survived largely in art and literature, but not so much in economics or social life. But the concept was based on a direct and we call lively perception of a true reflection of reality, the humanization of society and nature, according to traditional motifs. So romanticism moved very easily to idealism, where the brute object, the thing, of itself, told us nothing. Only when the object, any object you could think of, a river, a language, a house, a mind, only when that was brought into the daily life of a people and made part of their identity did it have any reality, just like the lung. That's the essence of idealism, because objects aren't really known as objects. Rather, they're symbols of deep and complex meaning. So to hold a lung from a cadaver in your hand and call it a lung is technically incorrect. It's only a lung if it's connected to everything else in a living organism and functions in a healthy way. Otherwise, it's a hunk of matter. Michael Cohen wrote on, he wrote on the Aesthetics of Change, from Ruskin's Gothic to Foster's Romantic Idealism, in 2011. And he's talking about E.M. Foster. He says, in fact, Foster's criticism is aimed as much at the perils of the modern marketplace and the shortcomings of democratic processes as at the lingering social orthodoxy. Foster's sublime aesthetics and romantic idealism extends Ruskin's democratizing emphasis on the sanctity of the individual's craft and divinity in the person's visual experience. Foster's values embody both a liberal social statement celebrating the promises of modernity and an ominous warning, as the modern world appears to spiral downward into industrial exploitation, class struggle, and moral corruption. Now, the language in what I just quoted there is very eccentric, but it's a clear argument. Romantic art, the rejection of the modern, whether it be in science or architecture or anywhere else, that the whole is not only greater than its parts, but the parts aren't really parts. They only come to their identity when they realize they're dependent on one another and the whole. It could be a building, it could be a civic meeting, it doesn't matter what it is. The concept of unity remains the same. There are no parts. There's the whole. The parts only make sense because there's a whole in the first place. Ruskin says that art is a joy that makes that man takes in God's creation. It's not his own. And in his writing, he actually underlines that. He stands in relation to the rest of creation. He's the pinnacle of creation, but doesn't endorse egotism. The entire ethical system here is that happiness derives from contentment, to be satisfied with little, to maintain few desires, and to be free from dissatisfaction as a result. In the work P.D. Anthony, John Ruskin's Labor, a study in Ruskin's social theory, we hear this. A moral practice is not a prudential act concerned with the success of the enterprise of agents. It is not instrumental to the achievement of any substantive purpose or to the satisfaction of any want. No doubt there may be advantages to be enjoyed in subscribing to its conditions. Perhaps honesty is the best policy. Perhaps speaking the truth is a condition of all durable association for the satisfaction of wants. But a moral practice, unlike an instrumental practice, does not stand condemned if no such advantage were to accrue. Indeed, recognizing and subscribing to those conditions may be expected to add to the costs of those transactions. Now, the modern nominalist would have absolutely no way to interpret what I just said, because they don't understand how you can separate action from efficient production. To them, it's the definition of absurdity. The modern doesn't care for truth. He cares for rationalization. He cares for efficiency and any good reason to ignore his conscience. In moral matters, the modern says, truth is not obtainable. So all is permitted. Well, almost everything is permitted. But the nature of the mind doesn't permit of nihilism. This doesn't make any sense. The mind is the very mind itself is a negation of nihilism. But a good moral rationalization is needed to quiet the collective unconscious. But Ruskin and the Romantics in general see all of this as connected. Capitalism is synonymous with modernity, as a money economy. If that's true, then usury is essential to modernity itself, because capital removes work from service. Capital forces work to become mercenary, the very opposite of the guilds working on the cathedrals. Service implies a strong social bond. You can't talk about service and charity without a social bond. Capital is the opposite. It implies an isolated ego. As he says, it becomes an exploitative and calculating relationship. So labor, when it becomes a matter of utility, loses any ethical function. So the capitalist mind, the individualist mind, sets men against one another. It implies isolation. So true labor, non-alienated labor, implies service, and that implies a strong social life and organic hierarchy. It gets worse when the exploitation of the common workman is then applied to luxuries. for the few that really have no real useful purpose. I did a whole thing on the rationality of capitalism, I think a few weeks ago. And in the same book, occult theft. Theft which hides even itself even from itself. Legal, respectable, and cowardly. Corrupts the body and soul of man. And the guilty thieves of Europe, the real sources of all deadly war in it, are the capitalists. That is to say, people who live by percentages on the labor of them, instead of a fair wage of their own. The real war in Europe, of which this fighting in Paris is the inauguration, is between these and the workmen, such as they've made him. They've kept him poor, ignorant, sinful, that they might, without his knowledge, gather for themselves the produce of his toil. At last, a dim insight into this fact dawns on him, and such as they have made him meets them, and he will meet. This is the revolutionary heritage of Romanticism. To think that the anti-capitalist movement was somehow Marxist is ridiculous. The war against the capitalist mentality was primarily a romantic, nationalist, and ethnic concern. It's a royalist idea. Like all of these people, you know, Marx and even some of the anarchists simply stole a lot of the insights from, you know, the very conservative reactionaries against the capitalist system. Capitalism, the so-called free market, these are revolutionary ideas. They're designed to destroy, as Karl Marx would say. Romanticism rejects all. It comes down to the relations of men that have been destroyed through the revolution. Modernity is, and capitalism is, a revolution. Regardless of any formal label, all modernity is about the duplicity that Machiavelli made essential to human life. Because only when it's debased in the first place, in this life, can anything like usury or rent be defended. The aesthetics of Romanticism should be connected to social criticism, and to show it is very significant for the modern age. There is no such thing as a moral idea that's not relevant anymore. Truth is no respecter of time. Only the modern who believes that he's living in the height of progress, you can only say that when you have a total lack of organic connection to the world around him. Nominalism removes the word from its referent. It rejects any universal truth, any intrinsic connection among objects themselves. It rejects universality and therefore truth itself. If that's true, that means words are arbitrary, as are the objects that they serve as a reference. If that's true, it means that the total conventionality of meaning places the very definition of truth, the world's insanity, in the hands of those powerful enough to define these words and influence behavior. The disconnect of words from both meaning and reference can be parallel to the rejection of care, of the wealthy for the poor, society in general, as Ruskin talks about. Because there's no intrinsic or organic bond connecting these floating egos, there's no imperative that commands their attention. University ethics has no relation to behavior. It's not meant to. It's a multiplication of theories, increasingly abstract and useless. Overanalyzed ideas, overpublication of concepts. But the critique of modern art is not an abstract exercise. It's a social criticism. Today, it's not an uncommon argument. There's tremendous production and scientific rigor, but more dissatisfaction. More information, less knowledge and ability. A massive profusion of moral ideas, total rejection of moral behavior. The very existence of the university discipline of ethics that has no relation to anyone's behavior shows a radical disconnect of modern nominalism. And this is what the romantic mentality was fighting and what it set its face against. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.